Good evening. Good evening, and thank you very much for coming. I'm Paul LeClaire, and it's my very great privilege to be the president of this great library and to welcome you on behalf of our marvelous chairman, Katie Marin, who's sitting here, as well as on behalf of the incomparable co-chairs of the President's Council, Louise Grunwald, Gayford Steinberg, and Alice Tisch, who have put together, as usual, a wonderful evening for you. And let's thank them, too. Thank you. And I'm really, on behalf of all of the trustees of the library and all of the staff, I'm very, very happy that you're here tonight on a snowy night and a night in which Wall Street took another dive. Because it gives me a chance to thank you, even with all of these storms of one kind or another going on, it gives me a chance to thank you for, on behalf of all of us, for the extraordinary generosity that you have shown to the library. Your support is immensely important to us, and it's wonderful to have you here so that we have a chance to thank you, to give you dinner, and to remind you of the very, very important work that we're doing. Our guest, of course, tonight is the brilliant writer Malcolm Gladwell, whose latest book, Outliers, The Story of Success, is another one of his bestsellers. But Mr. Gladwell won't be talking about his book tonight. He's going to be talking about another subject, underdogs, and that's going to be absolutely fascinating for you to hear. But before introducing him, let me just take a few moments to talk about the kinds of things that are happening at the library and why your involvement in it and in our work as members of the President's Council is so deeply, deeply, deeply important to us. First of all, our libraries and their collections and their services are being used more heavily now than they have been in about a half a century. I've got two slides to show you. The first one shows the enormous increase in the number of visits that we've had to the library in the last quarter of the last calendar year. The blue lines represent the number of visitors that we had in the same period in 2007. The green lines show the number of visitors that we had in 2008. Overall, in this quarter to quarter, year to year, there was a 13% increase in people coming to the library, which means a total of 2 million more people walking through the doors of our 91 facilities. In terms of what they were doing, in addition to using computers and databases and using the services of our staff to help them learn English and learn how to read and write in the dominant language of this culture, of this country, many, many people came to borrow things, to borrow books, to borrow DVDs, to borrow CDs. And the total number of things that were borrowed in that quarter represent an 18%, a very, very sharp increase over the prior year. And they represent 3.5 million more items that were checked out by the people in the three boroughs that we serve than in the year before. And the traffic that we have had in our branches and in our research libraries has increased even more strongly than these rates in the months of January and February. There's another terribly important thing that we're doing, and that is helping people to reposition themselves in this very, very, very challenging job market. And let me show you through a clip from WNBC News just what we're doing, and I think this will be even more persuasive than I ever could be about just how simply essential the New York Public Library is to the people of our town. Thank you. The essential thing is that we're so good, we're everywhere in town, and we're free. And record numbers of people are coming to us, and our objective is to continue to serve them, even in the down cycle, even in spite of some of the bad forecasts on our budget for next year. So please do stay with us, our supporters. It's terribly, terribly important to us, and even more important, it is the people that we serve that need to be helped by this great library. And now, for a feast of ideas, thanks to the generosity of Malcolm Gladwell for accepting to be our special guest this evening. Born in the United Kingdom and raised in Canada, Malcolm Gladwell read history at Trinity College of the University of Toronto. But for some time now, he's been one of us, a New Yorker. He's been a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. He's also been a reporter for the Washington Post and has served as that distinguished newspaper's New York bureau chief. Among his many awards, one of the single most impressive, I think, is his designation by Time magazine in 2005 as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. In addition to his journalistic pieces, Malcolm Gladwell is, of course, the author of three important books, that have enjoyed immense popularity and are clearly responsive to many of the issues that dominate in today's culture. His first book, which I'm sure everybody in this room has read, Tipping Point, How Little Things Make a Big Difference, shot immediately to the top of the bestseller list and stayed there for a very long period of time. As did his second book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. His most recent book, Outliers, The Study of Success, has been at the top of the New York Times bestseller list since November and still is. Mr. Gladwell, who was supposed to be here, but maybe he's there. There he is. Ah, okay. Mr. Gladwell, Malcolm, this library has always been a home for writers and a home for their books. And I know that you use this library and others within our system in your work. And we're delighted that you've accepted to be the guest speaker at the President's Council dinner tonight. A warm welcome to you.
Thank you. This is, as you heard, I'm Canadian, and this is one of those days that gives Canadians such as myself a sense of moral superiority. We would say that in Canada that New York has had a touch of snow. But I'm glad you all braved the touch of snow to come out. I didn't want to talk about Outliers because if I talk about Outliers anymore, I'll have to shoot myself. So I thought I would talk about something that a story that I've been working on for The New Yorker that I'm still thinking through. I just share with you the stage that I'm at in making sense of this story. It's a story that started a couple years ago when I met a man at a conference in California. And his name was Vivek. And Vivek is in the software business. And he's originally from Bombay, and he came here with, you know, $50 in his pocket and went to MIT and built up this business, and now he lives in Menlo Park, and he's very successful. And a couple years ago, he's a single father. His daughter, his 12-year-old daughter Anjali, decided that she wanted to play basketball, and so he agreed to be the coach of her team. And she was playing she's playing club basketball in California. It's a very big deal. It's called National Junior Basketball, and they have all these teams for little girls and boys and championships that go all the way to the national level. Now Vivek is this very, as you would imagine, he's a software guy. He's this very sort of calm, rational sort of person. And he, from the very beginning, when he decides to coach his daughter's team, he has two rules. His first rule is that he's never going to raise his voice. He figures that if he can't explain the strategy he wants to use to these girls calmly and rationally, he shouldn't even bother being a coach. So that's rule number one. That's not a rule that I'm terribly interested in, although I think it's a very important rule. I'm really interested in his second rule. Vivek is, as I said, an Indian. He didn't grow up with basketball. He grew up with soccer and cricket, and he really only sees a basketball game for the first time as an adult. And the first time he ever sees a basketball game, his first thought is how mindless it was. Because he watched this game and he saw that one team would score, and then after they scored, they would immediately run all the way back to their end of the court and wait for the opposing team to bring the ball up. And to him, this made absolutely no sense, right? Here you have a basketball court that's 94 feet in length, and yet people only played defense in about 20 feet of it. They just surrendered the other 74 feet to their opponent. Now, occasionally, they wouldn't do that. They would play defense the entire length of the court, right? They would start their defensive measures the instant the ball was being thrown in from out of bounds after a ball was scored. That's called a full court press. But when he looked at when people used the full court press, he discovered most teams never used it at all, and those teams that did use it would use it for about 1 or 2 minutes a game, right? And that's what Vivek found mindless. If you're going to let the other team just walk the ball up the court on 9 out of 10 occasions, what that does is give teams that are already better, that are already bigger and stronger, an even bigger advantage, right? What makes a team good is their ability to dribble, to pass the ball, but most importantly is their ability to shoot the ball, right? To execute beautifully choreographed plays. And if a team that was weaker simply let the stronger team walk the ball up the court and execute their beautifully choreographed plays, the weaker team was never going to beat the stronger team. was essentially surrendering before the game had even started. Now, this was of particular importance to Vivek because when he looked at his girls, his 12-year-old girls there in Menlo Park, he knew that they were going to be one of the weaker teams. These were little skinny girls with pigtails from Silicon Valley. Their parents were software tycoons. These were not girls who stayed up until midnight shooting hoops in the playground, right? These were not girls who even cared about basketball particularly. In fact, on his team of 10 girls, only two of them had ever even picked up a basketball before that particular season. They just wanted to play basketball because it was fun. And they only wanted to play about 1 or 2 hours a week. The rest of their time, they wanted to do what wealthy young girls from places like Menlo Park do, which is go skiing with their parents and ride horses and dream about being marine biologists and send text messages to their friends, right? So he knew that if he played basketball the traditional way and just let the other team walk the ball up the court, he was never going to win. And for someone like Vivek, who came here from Bombay when he was 17 years old with $50 in his pocket, the idea of never winning was absolutely impossible to swallow. So he had two rules. Rule number one was he was never going to raise his voice. And rule number two was that he was going to play the full court press absolutely every minute of every game. Right? And Vivek took that team of little blonde-haired, pigtailed, skinny Silicon Valley girls who didn't know how to shoot and didn't know how to dribble and had never played basketball before, he took them all the way to the national championships. As Vivek's daughter Anjali told me, it was so random. Now, I'm not going to talk to you this evening just about basketball. Obviously, that's not an appropriate topic for a very serious event like this. What I'm really interested in is what that story represents. That's a David and Goliath story, right? That team of little girls from Menlo Park is David, and they beat all of these Goliaths. And what that story raises is this really interesting question, which is, when does David beat Goliath? What does it take for the underdog to beat the favorite, right? Now, let's think for a moment about the original story of David and Goliath in the Bible. One of the most common misinterpretations of that story is that David's victory over Goliath was anomalous, that it rarely ever happens. In fact, when we look at real-life David and Goliath stories, we discover that that's not true at all. Davids actually win all the time. A couple years ago, there's a British political scientist named Ivan Toft who analyzed every single war fought over the last 200 years between two countries that were of radically different levels of power. And his measure was you had to have one country that was at least 10 times more powerful than its opponent in terms of GNP and size of population. And what he discovered was that if you look at those contests, those David and Goliath contests, Goliath wins 70% of the time and David wins 30% of the time. Now that's extraordinary, that countries who have 1/10 the economic might of their opponents win 1/3 of the time. Right? Then Toft does something that's even more interesting. He thinks back to the original story of David and Goliath. And remember in that original story, David tries on the armor and picks up the sword. And then he says, I will not use these. I cannot go with these because I have not proved them. He knew that if he used a sword against Goliath, he was going to lose. That was obvious to him. So that's when he famously picks up the 5 smooth stones, right, that he uses to defeat Goliath. So Toft says to himself, all right, why don't I look at instances where Davids do what David did, that is, change their strategy in the face of their overwhelming Goliath opponent. And when he looks just at instances where Davids change their strategy, what he discovers is that they win 64% of the time. In other words, the minute Davids take into account their weakness and compensate for it by changing their strategy, they win. And they don't just win some of the time, they win the overwhelming majority of the time. Now, let me give you an example of a classic David triumph. Lawrence of Arabia in the Middle East in 1917. Remember, he's leading the Arab revolt against the Turks, who at that point occupy much of the Middle East. And the British are very actively engaged in helping the Arabs because Turks are allied with Germany in the First World War. And the British are focused on the Turkish garrison in the city of Medina, in what is now Saudi Arabia. Because the Turks have built a railway line that runs from Damascus all the way down to Medina, and at the end of the railway line, they put this large group of troops. And Lawrence is leading this group of Arab irregulars, basically Bedouin tribesmen on camels. And the British really want him to attack and take out the Turkish garrison at Medina. And that notion is a very traditional notion of war, right? It says that you attack your enemy at the point of his greatest strength and annihilate him. That was the theory of war that was being used in the trenches in Europe at exactly the same time in the First World War. So Lawrence is charged with taking out Medina, and then he realizes one day, actually it's a very romantic story, he gets sick on a long trek across the desert, and in his delirium realizes that this strategy is nonsense. There's no way his ragtag group of Bedouin irregulars can possibly defeat the Turks at Medina. Instead, he realizes he has to fundamentally change his strategy. He has to do a David. He has to pick up 5 smooth stones. And what does he do? Well, his first thought is he shouldn't attack the Turks at their moment, at their point of strength. He should attack them at their point of weakness, right? He should ignore Medina and focus instead on this long, undefended railway line that connects Medina to Damascus, right? Secondly, he realizes the last thing he wants to do is focus the battle on one specific point, Medina. On the contrary, his best strategy, his best chance of winning, is to make the battlefield as large as possible, to expand it to the furthest reaches of Arabia, right? That's his best chance. And thirdly, he realizes that his best chance, the very things that make him successful, are the mobility of his and the motivation of his tribesmen, of his Arab irregulars. And he says this wonderful thing in describing the troops or the Arabs he was fighting with. He said, "Our largest available resources were the tribesmen, men quite unused to formal warfare, whose assets were movement, endurance, individual intelligence, knowledge of the country, and courage." They weren't trained. They didn't know what it meant to be a troop, you know, a soldier in an army. They didn't wear uniforms. They had zero discipline. They didn't bang on drums as they walked across a desert. What they had were different things. And he said, why don't I make use of those extraordinary gifts in waging this war against the Turks? Now, what he's describing, of course, what Lawrence of Arabia was doing when he described that, is describing the strategy of the insurgent. And all insurgents since that time, and even before, have used those principles in waging their wars. Now, what does that principle come down to? It comes down to the substitution of effort for ability, right? You're not well trained, you don't have lots of guns, you don't have all the things that armies usually have, but what you have is the ability to move around really quickly and work really, really hard, right? What you have is movement, endurance, intelligence, knowledge of the country, and courage. What were his irregulars? His irregulars were Arab Bedouin tribesmen on horseback who traveled very light. They traveled and they never had any more than a pint of water. These are people who are riding across the desert in the middle of summer, and they were able to get by with 40 pounds of flour and a pint of water. And they hated the Turks so profoundly that they were willing to travel as much as 110 miles a day, right, in pursuit of their enemy. They were this extraordinarily dedicated, mobile force. And if you look at a list of the engagements and the acts of sabotage that Lawrence of Arabia and his group conducted in the spring of 1917, it's extraordinary. They're basically they're blowing up some portion of that rail line between Medina and Damascus every single day. And the masterstroke, the pièce de résistance, I'll give up on that. The masterstroke of Lawrence of Arabia's campaign is his attack on Aqaba. And what he does with Aqaba, which is a port town, which was very focused on the fact that they would probably be attacked from the sea, what he does is this extraordinary, this is the thing that makes him a legend, this extraordinarily wide loop across the desert. And he comes and he attacks them from behind. Right? And he travels across the width and breadth, 1,400 miles in 3 weeks, with a ragtag group of troops. And he attacks Aqaba from behind and captures the city. With his group of just a few hundred troops, he captures or kills 1,200 Turks at a loss to his own group of just 2 people. Right? It's one of the most famous acts of insurgent warfare in the history of insurgency. And it served as this incredible model for how it is David can beat Goliath. If you're willing to ride 1,400 miles across the desert in 3 weeks, you can beat Goliath. You can substitute effort for ability. Now think about that in terms of what Vivek was doing with this little team. And I'm now going to do a little excursion into basketball. And for those of you who know basketball, this will be boring. And for those of you who don't know basketball, please follow along, because I'm going to try and make it as plain as I can. Right? When one team scores in basketball, the other team takes the ball out of bounds and has to inbound the ball, right? Put the ball in play. And they have 5 seconds to inbound the ball. And then once they have the ball inbounds, they have 10 seconds to get it over the center line of the court. And if they fail to meet either of those deadlines, they are required to give up the ball, right? Now, in most cases, because teams run back to their own end of the court after they've scored, this isn't an issue. It's no problem at all throwing the ball in, and it's no problem at all dribbling it over the center line within the 10-second time frame. What Vivek decides is that he is going to contest both of those deadlines. He's going to make it impossible for you to throw the ball in within 5 seconds. So he trains his girls to run around waving their hands in the air like maniacs and make it impossible for the other team to see where to throw the ball, right? And if they do manage to throw the ball in, what he trains his girls to do is to descend on the poor, hapless player who happened to have caught that pass and cover her and wave their hands like this and this until she panics and throws the ball away, right? And what, now think about what he's doing in the context of Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence attacked his opponent, not at their point of strength, but at their point of weakness. And that's exactly what Vivek is doing. The team he's playing against, their point of strength is their ability to execute an offensive play at the other end of the court. So he never lets them get to the other end of the court. Attack them when they're bringing the ball in, which is their moment of weakness. Lawrence Arabia said the key to beating Goliath was to extend the size of the battlefield as great as possible, right? Now, don't just focus on Medina, focus on the entire desert. That's what Vivek does. He doesn't just play defense for 20 feet, he plays it for 94 feet, right? And most of all, Lawrence said that if you're willing to ride 1,400 miles over 3 weeks in the desert, you can beat Goliath. And that's exactly what Vivek proved. He proved you could have a team that couldn't shoot. They never could shoot, and they couldn't dribble. They didn't know how to dribble. They hadn't played basketball before. They only practiced one hour a week, right? But what did they have? They had the ability, the desire, the motivation to run around and run around and run around and run around and make it impossible for the other team to get the ball in, right? In his practices, they didn't even practice shooting. All they did was run around. And you know what their cheer was? It was very simple. 1, 2, 3, attitude. That's all it was. It was an attitude, right? And what happens? They win. They win and win and win. They would typically get out to an 8-0 or a 10-0 or a 12-0 lead. The other team they found, if they did what they did, could never even get the ball in. One game they won, they were up 25-0 when the ref said, all right, you got to stop, right? It was getting out of control. One time, only 4 girls showed up. Only 4, because the rest had the flu. And they did the full court press anyway, and they lost by 2 points. 4 girls, right, against 10. That's how crazy these girls were. And they go all the way to the national championships in Los Angeles. This little group of skinny girls with pigtails from Menlo Park who don't even know anything about basketball. Vivek was the Lawrence of Arabia of 7th and 8th grade girls basketball in Silicon Valley. Now we come to the crux of why this is interesting to me. I say to Vivek, all right, so you were killing every other team in your league, right, with a bunch of girls who didn't know anything about basketball. When people saw you playing this way, did they copy you? Did everyone start doing the full court press in national junior basketball in Silicon Valley? And he said, no. No one ever copied me. And I said, what about the next year? After you proved, and by the way, in the history of national junior girls basketball in California, no team from Silicon Valley has ever gone as far in the nationals as this team. This does not happen, right? If you think about the composition of the kind of teams that come from Silicon Valley, they're not going to win the national championships, except in the case of Vivek. So I said, you did this thing that no one thought was possible. You went all the way to the nationals. The next year, did people copy you, right? Did they see what works? And he said, nope, no one ever copied us. So then I got interested in this, and I said, well, let's look at basketball in general. Maybe this is some quirk about a lack of intelligence in the coaching pool of Silicon Valley 7th and 8th grade basketball. What about basketball in general? Is there a coach at the professional level in basketball who has a David team, a team that's going nowhere? And does that coach use the full court press because that's the only way David's going to beat Goliath? And the answer is no. None of the weakest teams in the NBA ever use the full court press. What about in college basketball? Are there coaches in college basketball who have David teams who use this as their strategy? There's one coach, Rick Pitino, right? University of Louisville. So I went down to see Rick Pitino, and I said to Rick Pitino, why do you use the full court press? And he said, well, when I was a kid, I was playing for the University of Massachusetts, and we had on our team two players, a guy named Al Skinner, who went on and had a long, successful career in the NBA, and another guy named Julius Erving, one of the greatest basketball players of all time. And we had never lost a game at home. We were invincible. And one day, a group of little, skinny, short Irish Catholic guys from Fordham came to town. And the tallest player on their team was 6'5". And their best player, their forward, was 6'2". And they killed us. And why did they kill us? Because they used the full court press. And his eyes grew wide. And Rick Pitino then went on to be a coach. And he thought, wow, if a group of skinny Irish Catholic kids from the Bronx can beat Julius Erving at home using the full court press, I got to use it, right? So he began to use the full court press, and he built one of the most successful college careers of any coach in college basketball history. And so I said to him, how many others have followed your path? And he said, none of them. He said, in fact, the coach of the Fordham team, Digger Phelps, right, who engineered one of the greatest upsets in the history of Fordham basketball using the full court press, never used the full court press again. And in the early 1980s, Rick Pitino took a team, one of the most extraordinary stories of David beating Goliath in college basketball history. He took a team of five players, four of whom were, in his own words, slow, short, white guys, to the final four of the NCAA championship. And the leader of that team was a guy named Billy Donovan. And this was considered one of the most incredible, truly mediocre team, almost won the whole thing. Billy Donovan went on to be a very, very successful coach at the University of Florida, where he is to this day. Does Billy Donovan use the full court press, the thing that allowed him to have the greatest triumph of almost any college basketball player of his generation? No, he doesn't. And I said, well, do people come and see you and try and learn the full court press because you've been so insanely successful over the years with using it? And he says, every year they come. People come from all over the world, and they sit in my practices, and they take notes. And then a couple months pass, and I call them up, and I say, how's the full court press going? And they say, oh, we don't use it. Right. Here is a strategy that seems to be the only way for David to beat Goliath, and nobody uses it except for Rick Pitino and Vivek, right? Well, now, it turns out this is not just true of basketball. It's also true of insurgencies. One of the most interesting things that Toft found is that when you look at these cases when David goes up against Goliath, it isn't the case that all the time David's changed strategies and pick up five smooth stones. They rarely do it. Most of the time, David's pick up a sword in the real world and try and fight Goliath with a sword, even though they must know in their heart of hearts it isn't going to work. You know who's the best example of this? George Washington. In the American Revolutionary War, what did we have? It started as an insurgency. And the insurgency was extraordinarily successful in turning back the British, right? You guys were winning the war. And what happened when George Washington took over command in 1775 in Cambridge? Right? He decided he didn't want to be an insurgency anymore. He wanted to be a real army. And he put together the Continental Line, which is an army based on the British model. And you know what happened? He lost and lost and lost. And the only reason America ended up winning the war was the French bailed them out, right? Here is a strategy, in other words. There are strategies available to Davids in all kinds of situations, and Davids don't take them. Why is that? Now, that's obvious. That's the point at which where I'm at right now in my story is trying to figure out why that is. But I'll share with you just a couple of examples. One is that it's clear to me that substituting effort for ability, which is at the core of insurgency strategies, is clearly a lot harder than we think, right? When we think about what it takes to succeed, we generally think of ability, of skill, as being the rare commodity, and effort as being the common commodity. And we think the hard part is getting skill and the easy part is putting forth effort. That is actually completely backwards. The easy part is skill and the hard part is effort. In fact, in time and after time after time, it is clear that David's would rather lose than expend great effort. That's incredibly sobering, but I think that's true. That must be the conclusion of this. There's another even more important point, and it says that when it comes to innovating, because that's really what full court presses are, that's what David was. David was an innovator, right? When it comes to innovating, for David to do the kinds of things they need to do to beat Goliath, the primary constraint is not technological, or not knowledge-based, or not economic. The primary constraint is social. Right? It's that there is an idea out there about the way things ought to be. Right? Why didn't George Washington want to fight an insurgency, even though the insurgency was winning? Because he had a notion in his head of the way war ought to be fought, right? He was someone who was actually in love with the British Army. He tried to become an officer in the British Army. He had this fixed notion in his head that war was supposed to be fought a certain way, with discipline and people in bright uniforms playing on the drums and firing muskets in unison. And any other strategy, even a strategy that worked, didn't seem right to him. And because it didn't seem right, he shied away from it. Same thing with basketball, right? Why don't people use the full court press? Because it doesn't seem like basketball. Because it's a bunch of little girls running around waving their hands in the air, and they're not doing any of the things that we associate with basketball. They're not dribbling, and they're not shooting, and they're not scoring in the regular way. They're running around going like this. And some part of the basketball establishment rebels against that, thinks that's not what basketball is, and chooses to do it, even though it means they'll never have a chance of beating Goliath. You know, one of the most striking things that Vivek told me was how angry people got when he played that way. Right? The other team, and when he was up 6-0 and 8-0 and 12-0 and 20-0, they would start screaming at their girls, and then they would start screaming at the refs, and then they would start screaming at him, saying that he was cheating. Once he was playing a team, a much, much better team of girls who've been playing for years, who are all really, really tall, and he was killing them 20-0. And the opposing coach threw a chair onto the court. Another time, someone challenged him to a fight in the parking lot. Understand, this is a man who's 5'3" and 110 pounds soaking wet, right? There was something in the way that he played basketball that offended them. Even though he wasn't violating any rules, he was simply violating some predetermined social sense we have of the way basketball ought to be played. I'm reminded of that infamous speech given many years ago by the Dean of Columbia College in 1918. Herbert Hawks, and as many of you know, at that point in its history, Columbia College was in crisis. It was an old-line WASPy establishment that was really upset because so many of the children of Jewish immigrants in New York were making their way to Columbia. And the Columbia establishment was obsessed with the idea of trying to find a way to keep the Jews out. And their big argument against the Jews, what was it? It was that the Jewish kids were grinds, that they worked really hard. There's a great quote from Hawks. He said, "Their accomplishment is over 100% of their ability on account of their tremendous energy and ambition. I do not believe, however, that a college would do well to admit too many men of low mentality who have ambition but not brains." Now, quite apart from the absurd anti-Semitism in that remark, think about what he's saying. He's saying that those Jewish kids were insurgents, right? They came from public high schools in the Bronx and Brooklyn. They didn't have nearly as good an education as their counterparts who were coming from Choate and Horace Mann. And how did they compensate? By working harder, by substituting effort for preparation, right? By playing the full court press. That's what they were doing. And Hawks had this notion of what it meant to be a university student that was very different. That said, what it meant to be a student was to conduct yourself with a certain amount of gentility and leisure. His notion of what it meant to be a university student was that you would walk slowly and calmly back to the other end of the court and let the other team come to you. And I wonder if that idea isn't still around, if we don't still have senses where we object to innovation, to new ideas, because they don't seem right. because they violate some kind of social code. I think that's a very, very relevant note to make at this point, when so much of what we do is up in the air. You know, we do all kinds of things as a society to keep David in his place. I think we need to ask ourselves whether we do those things for a reason, or whether we do those things because of an entirely irrational attachment to the way things ought to be. Thank you so much. I have time for questions? Oh, good. Fire away. If anyone has any questions, sure.
Is there an element in the David Goliath thing of the expectation of Goliath of the way David will behave? In other words, the surprise of a different strategy might also contribute to the...
Yes. Yes, so David, well, this is, the David story is really interesting. David is, of course, a shepherd, right? Goliath is a warrior. And Goliath expects that he's having a ritualized battle with another warrior. And David is an outsider and doesn't know that there are these rituals about the way one ought to fight in this kind of context. So the outsider is, very often it's the outsider who comes and who challenges expectations in this area. The Jews at Columbia were the same way. They were one generation off the boat. They had no idea that what it meant to be a university student was to sit around drinking martinis and playing polo, right? They thought, weirdly, that when you went to a university, what you should do is study, right? They had no sense that there was this existing set of rules that governed your behavior. Similarly with Vivek, the whole reason Vivek is able to see basketball in this different way is that he's not American. He grew up with soccer. And of course, in soccer, do they run to the other end of the field and await the other team? No, they play defense the entire field. So of course, someone raised in soccer would look at the way Americans play basketball and think it was absurd. So this is this wonderful, I can riff forever on this fact because it's really fascinating. But this is this wonderful, this is one of the reasons why outsiders are so critical for innovation, because they don't have this baggage about the way things ought to be. Sure.
How do you think Goliath Petraeus should deal with Lawrence of Afghanistan?
Oh, I see, yes. Well, this is, we're now getting into areas that are well outside of my, above my pay grade, as our president likes to say. I think we have to be clear that when we are, I mean, this notion of this substitution of effort for ability is a crucial one. Another way, in political science, what they talk about is cost tolerance, and that is how many things are you willing to endure in order to win? And one of the things that we know about countries that are being invaded is that their cost tolerances are often much higher than their invaders, right? So you can do a cost tolerance analysis of Vietnam, for example, which says that if Vietnam were like any other country in history, we would have won the war in 1968. But their cost tolerance was like 3 times higher than we'd ever experienced before. In fact, the only country in history with a higher cost tolerance, by which we mean what percentage of your civilian population are you willing to see killed before you quit, before you give up? Highest cost tolerance by that measure in history is Soviet Union in the Second World War, right? Second highest was the North Vietnamese in the Vietnam War, right? Their cost tolerance was way, way high. We went in there thinking it was here, and it was here. So when we engage in these battles, even if they are well-intentioned, we have to be absolutely clear going in that our enemy's cost tolerance is higher than us, and they are substituting effort for ability, and that means we have to stick around if you're gonna win. And this notion of a quick victory is an illusion. Yeah.
It seems tough to have an outsider come in and innovate.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a good example. Public schools are great examples of places. Public schools, schools and hospitals are the two leading examples of places where people do things because they think that's the way they ought to be done without any particular reason for doing them. One of the things, interesting things we've seen in the school world is how positive the influence of outsiders have been in school reform in the last 10 years, right? That we've been importing people from the business world or people from different cultures who have come in with a completely different set of expectations, and I think that's been incredibly healthy. What I would like to see is that process continue. In fact, you know, there is a wonderful opportunity in our current doldrums, and that is there are lots of really, 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 really able people who have lost their jobs or who are about to lose their jobs, and I would love to rotate a lot of them through the schools, if for no other reason that I think it would be a really, really great idea to get people who were not part of the school system to be teachers for a bit, not forever, not teaching a full load, but to get some, you know, a techie guy laid off from a software firm to teach math at a high school for 2 classes a week for a while. That would be a great idea because that person would come in with a very different set of ideas about how things ought to be done, and that could be incredibly healthy. It really could be have a wonderful outcome. Sure.
Ah,
oh dear. You know, well, actually, I'll back up. I won't answer the question because I don't know how to answer it, but I will answer the meta question, which is, so at what point does David become Goliath? So if Vivek wins every game, is he actually Goliath by the end, right? And I think no, because you know what happens? This is interesting. I didn't tell the story, but Vivek doesn't win, his team doesn't win the national championship. They lose in the semifinals. And the reason they lose is that they play a team in Newport Beach, and they play them on their home court with their own referee. Remember, this is seventh grade girls basketball. I mean, there are no standards of professionalism here. And the referee decides that the way Vivek is playing is wrong. Vivek's team's playing is wrong. And he calls 4 times as many fouls against Vivek's team than he does against the other team, and they lose. And they're basically cheated of their victory. And at the end, the crowd is booing, and they lose by like 4 points. So they were still with David. They were still violating norms. And eventually it caught up with them, very kind of tragically. And so I think as long as you continue to violate norms and to do things differently, you're always going to be David, even if you have all kinds of victories under your belt. Until the whole basketball world embraces the full court press, Vivek's going to be an underdog. I think that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
That was too hard a question to keep going with. I want to thank you very much for coming out tonight. Really, on behalf of Louise and Gayford, it means so much to us to have you here. The President's Council is really one of the most important groups for the library because it really supports the most essential programs. But one of the things I think they've learned tonight is that, in fact, you're really the best friends of the libraries, because only your best friend would come out for you on a night like this. So we really thank you for that. We thank Malcolm Gladwell. That was a wonderful, very thoughtful speech, and it's given us a lot to think about. We invite you to come upstairs and join us. All of everyone here is a member of the President's Council, or you're a friend of the library in a special way, and we invite you to also join the President's Council or to bring other friends along, and we'll discuss more over dinner. So thank you.